Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be discussing free will and morality. So I have a couple of announcements before we get started today. First, the patrons reached the first support goal, and now there are monthly bonus episodes on the patron-only feed about philosophy and science more generally as it relates to religion, or just about living as an atheist and a naturalist, along with more niche topics within religion that didn't quite merit their own episode. A few months ago, I also posted my deconversion story, if any of you are interested in that, but the purpose of the bonus episodes was to create an outlet where we could discuss interesting or useful topics that are maybe only tangentially related to religion, or are just really good to know if you're thinking about atheism, but don't really need their own episode. So those are beginning very soon. Thanks again to all my lovely patrons for making that happen, and I hope you get something out of them. And second, for the time being, I'm moving to a bi-weekly schedule for releasing episodes. With my job, it's been hard to get the shows to a place where I'm happy with them, and I don't want to make subpar content. Once I get to $75 an episode, I'll take a day off work per week just to write and record, and I'll be back on the weekly release schedule. I want to take some time to elaborate why I think this question of free will matters. Whether believers want to acknowledge it or not, Christianity makes claims about the universe and how it works. It makes claims about how human beings work. Our best science-based and evidence-based answers to many questions are in direct conflict with the Christian answers to these questions. Everything from how did we get here, where are we going, and what kind of creatures are we, all the way to more specific questions like how old is the earth, and do human beings have free will? Every discipline that answers questions that Christianity already tried to answer has historically been vehemently opposed by Christians. That is, before small sectors of Christians see the writing on the walls and try to square their belief system with our new knowledge. Biology, geology, psychology, physics, and much of philosophy, all these fields have and are still having conflicts with religious people, or at least people who still take religion seriously. If you read apologetics literature, believers passionately defend the idea of libertarian free will. This is because they understand how crucial free will is to their theology and to their basic narrative about who we are. Most versions of Christianity don't make sense without free will. How can somebody deserve hell? And I could stop there, but how could somebody deserve hell if they don't have complete metaphysical freedom? If people aren't ultimately responsible for their actions, how does it make sense to punish them for an eternity, let alone say that they chose to reject God, and that's why they're burning? In church, I heard it a million times. God doesn't send anyone to hell. You send yourself to hell. And you send yourself to hell through your choices. Your choice to reject God, your choice to sin, etc. But if you choose to accept salvation, you're rewarded with heaven. This narrative is fairly absurd, but realize just how incoherent it becomes if we don't even have free will. Or consider the problem of evil. Why is there so much suffering? Well, that's because of human free will. This is a terrible answer, as we talked about back in episode 3, but it's the most popular answer to the gratuitous suffering we see in the world. If human beings don't have Christian free will, then they've lost their favorite theodicy. But I think that on Christianity, free will makes even less sense because of the existence of an omnipotent, omniscient God. If our choices and beliefs can be altered by changing a few genes, or by having different parents, or having different experiences, then God must know ahead of time if we're going to accept or reject him and end up in heaven or hell. Not only must he know what's going to happen and what we're going to choose, but he must be partially responsible for it. I didn't choose my parents, did you? I didn't choose my genes, I didn't even choose to be born, let alone where in the world I was born and in what time period. God chose all those things for me, and we know beyond a shadow of a reasonable doubt that these things affect our beliefs and choices. If you were born a few hundred years ago, or if you had different peer groups or different familial groups, you'd probably have different beliefs. Especially if God interferes in anything, like if he answers prayers or something along those lines, he would have to know the ripple effect of his actions and how they'd influence future events. The kind of free will Christianity needs to make any sense is libertarian free will, total metaphysical freedom that can step outside the long chain of cause and effect and add new things into the causal chain that aren't themselves the result of prior causes. And this is the free will that we spent last episode debunking. So now I want to address the most common objection to determinism from believers, which is that some crucial part of our morality is threatened if we have no free will. So far, I've neglected to mention a view of free will called compatibilism, and this has been intentional. I have my views on compatibilism, but it's a question to be hashed out among non-believers. It has virtually nothing to do with religion as I see it. Much of what I'll be saying today does relate to compatibilism, since that discussion has a lot to do with moral responsibility and the language we should use around it. However, compatibilist free will is of no help to the Christian, as it does not rescue any of their theology. And like I said, it's an issue that we naturalists and atheists have to sort out among ourselves. The mainstream Christian conception of free will is what I've been arguing against, libertarian free will. This is the unjustifiable version of free will that the last episode was about. The Christian conception of free will is actually pretty easy to square with morality. You're morally responsible for what you do because you chose to do it. But in a naturalistic world where human thought and behavior is entirely subject to cause and effect, this doesn't work in quite the same way. The question of morality is something I take very seriously, and it's why I'm taking the time to do this episode. I think that the most intellectually honest position of an atheist is determinism, and our conception of morality that was built around our belief in libertarian free will may need some nuancing in the wake of our new knowledge. The most common objection to determinism from Christians, in my experience, is to say that without free will, we have no morality. Society will fall apart. People will murder in the streets. Chaos will ensue if there's no free will. So let's see if their assessment has any merit.
A person is not morally responsible for an action which he is unable to avoid. But Sam Harris believes that all of our actions are causally determined and that there is no free will. If there is no free will, then no one is morally responsible for anything.
I don't think that having causal responsibility is the only conceivable way to assign praise or blame. I think this issue is a lot more nuanced than Craig is admitting here, but I'll come back to that in a second. First, I think of morality in terms of consequences and suffering. No free will is necessary for suffering to be bad and for us to want to minimize suffering for conscious creatures. If our morality is defined as that which minimizes suffering while maximizing freedom, no free will is needed to see behavior as good or bad. More importantly, a lack of free will doesn't mean that we can't contain or rehabilitate those who behave antisocially. Imagine if there was a dog who bit several people on the street. We don't need immaterial souls, objective morality, or Christian free will to lock the dog up, not let him around people he could hurt, or, if possible, condition him or change his internal chemistry so he doesn't hurt anyone. The dog can be just an organism, a product of his genes and environment, and we'd still be justified in containing or rehabilitating him. The crucial point is that moral responsibility and causal responsibility don't have to be the same thing. It's clear that if you have causal responsibility, you have moral responsibility, but this doesn't go both ways. Having moral responsibility does not necessarily entail having causal responsibility. I think that moral responsibility can be preserved in a certain sense, and that we have every right to rehabilitate or contain any person who's behaving badly. We have every right to morally condemn them publicly, since doing so will deter similar behavior from themselves and others, at least to a certain extent. On the other hand, I fully recognize that we are not the ultimate cause of our actions, even if we intentionally, voluntarily commit murder. This puts me in the company of moral responsibility skeptics, I'm told, but I don't see how these divisions are useful. I don't know of anyone who shares my view that we have no free will, and also thinks that we have no right to jail or attempt to rehabilitate criminals, or thinks that we shouldn't try to deter immoral and antisocial behavior. And this seems to be what some proponents of using free will language are trying to preserve, but I know of absolutely no one who actually thinks that because we live in a deterministic universe, we should just free all violent criminals. And if there was someone advocating that, no one should listen to that person. So what problem is the division between these two camps solving exactly? I see no contradiction between the ideas that 1, a murderer has no free will, and 2, we should try to stop murder through means of deterrence, imprisonment, rehabilitation, and so on. What I usually say is that I think we have moral responsibility but not causal responsibility for our actions. Think about an asteroid like the one that killed the dinosaurs. If determinism is true, someone committing murder is no different than an asteroid hurtling towards Earth. No one would say that it's unfair or unjustified to blow up the asteroid before it's a danger to Earth, and no one should think that it's unfair to imprison a murderer, even if his actions are just as determined as the asteroids. If a person's actions were premeditated or their actions were in line with their intentions, then we judge them. And this is maintained in a deterministic universe. There's still a difference between voluntary and involuntary action, and intentional and unintentional action. If we want to preserve the notion that our legal system and moral views should distinguish between voluntary and involuntary actions, intentional and unintentional, we can still do this without using free will language. An action performed with a gun to your head is importantly different than one performed voluntarily. An intentional murder is importantly different from manslaughter. We can preserve these distinctions in our legal system and moral judgments while still recognizing that we have no ultimate control. Even if you don't agree with this, you can at least admit that these notions are pragmatically useful for building a functioning, healthy society. Even though these are socially useful concepts that we should preserve, we have to distinguish between building a justice system that works well and honestly inquiring into how human beings work. We have to recognize that the universe doesn't care what's socially useful, and determinism makes even these lines that we've drawn blurry. Take the case of a 40-year-old man who was arrested in the year 2000 for possession of child pornography and for molesting his 8-year-old stepdaughter. The man had no prior history of pedophilia, and he said that he was baffled and dismayed at his sudden turn in sexual behavior. While he was awaiting trial, he complained of migraine headaches, and it was discovered that he had a tumor in his orbital frontal cortex, a brain region associated with sexual impulses. The tumor was removed, and his pedophilic impulses stopped. About a year later, his pedophilic behavior returned, and a brain scan revealed that the tumor was back as well. The tumor was removed again, and so was the man's pedophilia, and this time for good. Or take the case of Charles Whitman, who killed his wife and mother and then shot dozens of people from a tower at the University of Texas in Austin. Whitman's suicide note revealed his tortured feelings and documented his shock and horror at his own budding violence. He had gone to a doctor and explained for hours how he felt violent and didn't know why. He wrote that he loved his wife dearly and he couldn't rationally understand why he felt the way he did. He requested an autopsy because he wanted his brain to be studied. It was discovered that he had a brain tumor compressing his amygdala, which is involved in emotional regulation, including aggression. We fully recognize these behaviors as probably caused by those tumors. Even though those actions were all voluntary and intentional, we still feel that they sort of deserve less blame. So here's the question. How are these examples with tumors really different from any other behavior? If your behavior is caused by prior physical events, then it's not really different than a tumor. A tumor is a particularly obvious example of something physical leading to behavior, but if we were super intelligent and knew all the relevant physical data about you and your circumstances, all your thoughts and behavior would be just as obvious and predictable. As Sam Harris has said, it's tumors all the way down. Charles Whitman chose to do what he did, and yet we judge him differently than someone who would do the same thing with no tumor compressing their amygdala. But again, if we knew everything and could see the entire chain of causes, every action would be as clear as one caused by a brain tumor. And take a less serious example, like fighting with your husband and then realizing that his crabbiness is due to low blood sugar. This is a purely physical and deterministic cause, but you don't feel stripped of moral agency by this information. It doesn't degrade you or make you feel like a robot. It frees you to understand the actual cause and fix it and prevent it in the future. And there's no reason this couldn't apply to all behavior. The philosopher Thomas Nagel famously wrote an essay entitled Moral Luck, in which he argues that luck plays a bigger role in our lives than we tend to admit. He explores this idea primarily to discuss moral responsibility, which is relevant to determinism, but it's also relevant to determinism in a more direct way. Intuitively, you'd think that people couldn't be held morally accountable for what is not their fault or what happens due to factors beyond their control. But according to Nagel, a significant aspect of what someone does depends on factors beyond their control, yet we continue to treat them as an object of moral judgment. So even though in the abstract it seems wrong to judge people for things that are outside their control, we actually do it all the time. The common example of moral luck is to imagine that someone drives home a little drunk. They know they shouldn't be driving, but they get in the car and go home. At one point, the driver veers slightly off the road, but he quickly corrects the diversion and gets home safely. We might chide that person and tell them not to do it again, but imagine a different driver in the same exact scenario, with all the same decisions and conditions, except where the driver veers slightly off the road, a child happens to be walking, and the driver hits and kills the child. The actions and characters of the two drivers are identical. They both drove home slightly impaired, but one driver had the bad luck of a child being in the wrong place at just the wrong time. Even though they behaved identically, we tend to judge the second driver more harshly. We don't view him as worse just because of the consequences of his actions, we actually see his actions as worse. We judge him to be a worse person than the first driver, even though they did the same thing. Even if the first driver had been caught driving drunk, he would have been treated more lightly by the police, legal system, and the court of public opinion than someone who behaved in the same exact way, but was unlucky. One person gets a ticket, the other may go to prison, and the difference between them was luck. But the luck of our circumstances can have even more dramatic moral consequences. Hannah Arendt, in a report on the banality of evil, observed that many Nazis were not monsters, but rather morally average people who simply complied with authority and followed orders. According to her, even Adolf Eichmann was a disturbingly normal person. The famous Stanford prison experiment demonstrated, to our immense discomfort, that humans are far more compliant to authority than we tend to admit. And this is yet another area where luck is important to how you end up being morally judged. You can't take responsibility for the fact that you don't live in 1930s and 40s Germany. Luck also affects your disposition, personality, and temperament. You didn't choose your genes. Some of us are prone to anger and some of us are very easygoing. Some of us are naturally friendly and some of us are painfully shy. Some of us have a positive affect and others are naturally cynical. And we can definitely work against these dispositions that we have, but that doesn't change the fact that some of us have to work really hard to have positive traits and others don't. It's not that our natural traits can't be cultivated or resisted, but if it's easy for you to be kind and comes naturally to you to be outgoing, you can't really take credit for your disposition. If it takes immense self-control to resist anger or jealousy, you can't really be blamed for your constitutive bad luck, and a person who doesn't struggle with these feelings at all can't take credit for their constitutive good luck. Nagel writes, quote, "How can one be responsible even for the stripped-down acts of the will itself if they are the product of antecedent circumstances outside the will's control? As the external determinants of what someone has done are gradually exposed in their effect on consequences, character, and choice itself, it becomes gradually clear that actions are events and people things. Eventually, nothing remains which can be ascribed to the responsible self, and we are left with nothing but a portion of the larger sequences of events which can be deplored or celebrated, but not blamed or praised." End quote. In a naturalistic, deterministic world, actions are events and people are things, but as Nagel says, we can still honestly deplore or celebrate actions. We can still detain criminals, deter crime, prevent bad things from happening, incentivize good things to happen, and try to rehabilitate those who do bad things. We can praise and blame in a certain sense without assigning causal responsibility, just in the interest of incentivizing those types of behaviors and characters. The point of this episode is essentially this. Determinism doesn't mean the end of morality. Determinism forces us to face the fact that if we had a murderer's genes, environment, and bad luck, we would be that murderer. But that doesn't mean that we don't try to stop him or condemn his actions as immoral. It just forces us to look with utter humility at ourselves and our place in the universe. That's all I have for you today. I have new patrons to thank, Justin Olby, Matthias, and I have to thank my first patron ever, Alec Kosmensky, for increasing his support. Thank you guys so much. It means a lot to have your support for what I'm doing. And you can support this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode and access to bonus episodes. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want society to devolve into a relativistic hellhole because there's no free will, you can like us on our social media or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you can. That one was not as good as usual. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.